Hi, and welcome to the Political Science Podcast, No Problem at All. In this podcast, we want to talk to political scientists about their research in the context of bigger developments in society and politics. We will have one guest per episode, and we base each episode around one or more papers that lie at the core of our guests' research interests. Us, that is the co-host, Julius Kölzer, and myself, Viktor Burgi. Hi, Julius. Welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Viktor. Welcome to the podcast. We are graduate students of political science based in Kiel and Zurich. And the idea of this podcast is to provide a platform so that insights of political science can reach a broader audience.
Today, we talk to Magdalena Breyer, who is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Basel in Switzerland. Before that, she was a PhD student at the University of Zurich. Her research revolves around the role of social status for political attitudes and political behavior.
Magda has recently published an exciting paper on the extent to which the perceived political representation of women affects the political behavior of male and female voters. More specifically, she examined whether stagnating female representation affects progressive mobilization of females. Also, she investigated whether increasing representation of women might lead to a conservative backlash among men.
Welcome to the podcast, Magda. It's great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
So in the last decades, the share of women in Western European parliaments increased significantly, and there is an ongoing debate in political science to what degree this might affect not only the representation of female interests, but also the political preferences of male and female voters. In your paper that Julius just mentioned, you investigated what effect the presence of women in parliament has on the political behavior of men and women. Can you roughly describe what the general interest of your paper was and what was so interesting about this question for you?
Yeah, sure. So maybe as a background, this paper was part of my PhD, and that was overall interested in the implications of changing status hierarchies or changing power relation between groups in societies. And gender was one core aspect of this. So, and then I focused on women's representation or this political dimension as my core interest for this paper, because this access to political rights, both in a passive or active way, is really crucial for how much a social group is heard in society or can also advocate for their own interests. So I was interested in how this, in a long-term perspective, women's access to power would change, basically, relations between groups and their voting behavior as well. And then more specifically, maybe I was also interested in kind of changing perspective a bit from not only looking at potential backlash outcomes or how maybe the left behind or the so-called left behind or radical right voters interpret changing societies, but also how the groups that are still on the lower end of the hierarchy or disadvantaged in some sense would react to the development of the inequality over time. And maybe if they would be happy with how it's developing, or if they also see a lot more potential for dismantling inequalities. So this was the focus on women that I was interested in with this paper. So the main background for this is kind of that it's kind of ambivalent to think about how this gender inequality is developing, right? So on the one hand, you could say in the last 100 years, we have seen a lot of progress in the increase of female representation, as you said. But on the other hand, it's been really stagnating for the last decades in many Western European societies. So this is kind of gives an interesting perspective on how different groups perceive this.
Okay. And more than that directly towards the paper you wrote, what is the specific question you investigated there? Because, I mean, the overarching context is super interesting, but I was wondering what specific question you investigated in the paper and at what specific puzzle you looked at.
Yes, that's a good question. So the specific question was how men and women react to different trajectories of women's representation and how this relates to kind of status dynamics. And so I was interested in whether men would react with a backlash to a strong increase in women's representation over time, And vice versa, whether women would be discontent with stagnation in the last decades. And the backlash would be, for example, visible in like perceptions of a lower subjective social status, also attitudes about political deprivation, discontent, and vice versa for women, a perception maybe of a higher social status or also discontent, content. And ultimately, I mean, in political science, then we're, of course, also interested in how these people vote. And there I was mainly interested in the difference between radical right voting propensities and whether these are connected to a potential male backlash or green voting propensities as a progressive party that would maybe mobilize women's votes.
One follow-up question I have on this, because it's interesting. I mean, one thing that's interesting here is the question of why you are looking at the effect of perceived trajectories of women representation and not a certain level of it, right? You're looking at how the trajectory of representation changed and what effect this has, and not just the level of women representation at a given time point, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I think that interest is kind of inspired by this literature on status trajectories over time. So how you interpret where your group is now is really like how this affects you emotionally or psychologically is really impacted by how you think this has changed over time. And also, really importantly, what you expect to happen in the future. So if I just present you a level, for example, 35% of women in parliament, you could think, oh yeah, but if this increased like in 10% over the last years, this is a really great thing. But if you think we have been there since 2005, it's a bit of a more ambivalent story. And then also what I then did in the paper, I kind of also try to present like a most likely future scenario to kind of increase this story of expectation from past to future.
Yeah, we'll talk about this methodical approach a bit later. Mm-hmm. But first, I'd be interested in hearing more about your theoretical argument, how the trajectory is perceived both for male and female voters. What was your argument there to address this question?
Mm-hmm. So the main theoretical background or argument I make is related to this notion of social status politics. So that is basically the motivation by groups to maintain or increase their position in the social status hierarchy. And that is a hierarchy that's based on like esteem or worth of different social groups. So then if you connect this to the like development of inequalities, you can see that high status groups have an interest in maybe maintaining this inequality or defending their own position. Especially when it's threatened. So when the inequality is kind of changing or when women are gaining status. And then on the other hand, lower status groups want to improve their position. If they do not manage to do that, or if they see that their position is not increasing, then this is also related to, or in my argument, related to political outcomes. So, for this one side with the male backlash, we already have quite a lot of literature that looks at how different changing gender hierarchies in the labor market, in politics, in education affect men's attitudes, men's reactions. But for the other side of how women react and those that want to increase their status, we do not really have a lot of knowledge, especially if you take into account this potential perspective that it's not enough or too little too little change and too slow. So there I argued that if women are discontent with how the trajectory is developing, then they might be mobilized to vote for a progressive party to kind of alleviate this or to improve their position. So the Green Party or a progressive party in generally maybe new left parties would be a most likely benefactor of this sentiment, because they combine high descriptive representation of women and also like a feminist substantive representation.
Yeah, now you mentioned descriptive and substantive representation. I think this is very fundamental when we talk about parliamentary representation in general. Could you introduce these two terms briefly, maybe?
Yes, sure. So the descriptive representation refers to how different social groups are actually represented so whether women sit in parliament, lower class people sit in parliament, different social groups, and how whether MPs have these characteristics. And substantive representation refers to the representation of interests or policy positions, basically. So, and now in this paper, I focused on kind of the descriptive representation, but it's really interesting to think about the connection, because on the one hand, you could think that these perceptions are kind of interlinked. So if I show that women's that the share of women is increasing in parliament, I would expect that many people think, most of these women may be feminists or maybe for more leftist parties, because that is actually what we see, that the most women in parliaments are more, or the left parties have more women. So this connection is kind of also grounded in empirics. But on the other hand, of course, I don't have control over what people then perceive of the what these MPs do or from which parties they are. So, and then it's also important to say that, of course, the descriptive representation, I try to really focus on this because I think it is important for this group politics character of that I'm interested in. But on the other hand, of course, also men can substantively represent women's interests and vice versa. All depends, of course, on what the interests of the voters are. So there are, of course, also radical right women politicians. And that is important to keep in mind.
Maybe we can then come to the results, because I'm now super excited after hearing all these exciting theoretical arguments. Maybe what was your empirical approach in the paper, and then what were your results that you reached at the end? What did you find out about those hypotheses you just mentioned?
Yeah, so I already mentioned how a bit how I presented these different trajectories. And how I did that concretely was to use a survey experiment that was fielded in Germany. And I plotted basically historically accurate data on the share of women and men in parliament. And on in the one treatment condition, the share of women since the 80s was really strongly increasing. And the share of men, because it's, of course, a zero-sum game in the end for real, because if there are more women in parliament, then relatively there are less men. And then I projected this plotted line into the future. So the respondents in this treatment condition saw that the lines were actually crossing. So that meant like an overturning relation of the genders in parliament, which was, of course, I also told the respondents this was a potential future scenario. And then in the other treatment condition, which did not go back to the 80s, but only to 2005. And if you only look at this time scale, then the share of women in the historically accurate data is actually not increasing. So then I showed just two parallel lines to the respondents, and also the future development then indicates that there would not be parity in the near future, or also not an overturning of gender hierarchies. So, maybe also to explain a bit why I used the survey experiment, because then you can really causally trace back the reactions to just this different perception of how the trajectory is developing, and not to other maybe context factors that would otherwise impact how you interpret gender hierarchies and their changes. And then to come to the results, or if you have another question in between.
I'm just to maybe give a quick explanation for those who aren't very familiar with the survey experiment idea in general. So you basically have then the two groups, and one group is shown the trajectory where the lines cross, basically, of the share of women and men. And the other group is shown at the trajectory where the lines don't cross, but more or less develop parallelly in the next decades. So one little detail I found interesting reading your paper was that you don't actually, let's say, lie to the survey respondents, because the data you show of the actual share in the past is correct in both for both treatment groups, right?
Yeah. That was also really important to me too, because I think there are a lot of cool ways to have like ethically sound survey experiments where we can find out a lot of cool things. And I mean, this also just relates to, I think, my own kind of perspective on these changing inequalities. So on the one hand, you can always find progress, or not always, but in most cases, you can find some progress if you look at a certain time scale. But if you change the perception slightly or the time scale, then it looks different. So I was trying to make use of this own ambivalence that many people have in them, including me. Then maybe also important to say that I didn't only have these two groups, but then also a control group that did not receive any information on women's representation or gender equality. So that is kind of like the benchmark of then how these different treatments can diverge.
So what were the results then that you found?
Yes. So maybe to start with the women perspective. So there I found that when they see the stagnating trajectory, so when they see that women's representation does not increase and remains well below parity, so below 50%, then they're mobilized to vote for the Green Party in Germany, so for a progressive party. And on the other hand, if they see that the share of women is increasing, this effect is not happening. So that kind of told me that it's really this kind of perception of unfairness that their group is not equally represented or doesn't have an equal maybe voice in politics that motivates them to vote for a progressive party to increase their standing in the future. I did test this effect for different parties, not only for the Green Party, but it really made sense to me that the Green Party was the one that benefited from this because, as I said before, they have a high share of women MPs also on their lists. They have gender quotas on their lists, and they combine this also maybe in a credible way with substantive feminist policies, where it makes sense that women who then see this information in the treatment and think, oh, this is not really fair, then the Green Party is the kind of obvious party they choose.
And what results have you on the male side? What was the male reaction on seeing the different trajectories of women representation in parliament?
Yes, this is also really interesting finding that I will maybe contextualize afterwards. But first, I did not find that men react with a backlash to increasing women's representation. And this was also surprising to me. But because I did expect that this increase of women, especially if you think about the future and maybe a high, like even higher share of women than men, that men would not find this fair, and would also feel like their group maybe will lose political power in the future. And this was one outcome that I asked, but I did not find an effect on this like deprivation perception, and also not on the radical right party support for the AfD. So yes, that is kind of good news. So it means that that even though I tried kind of to induce this backlash perception of like, oh, women are losing, women are gaining at the expense of these male MPs, this does not happen.
But do you have an interesting, or doesn't have to be an interesting explanation, but do you have an explanation at all about why you see this divergence in the findings? I mean, why you don't see the effect for male voters?
Yeah. So I thought about this a lot over the last couple of years. And so I think there are two perspectives, and I think both are a bit correct, or both have some grain of truth. And the one would just be a very optimistic one, that both men and women value descriptive representation and think it's good that groups are represented in parliament as their share in the population is. And then this is also has actually been shown by other research before, more in the gender and politics literature, that men behave sociotropically. That means that they believe that they think about the good for overall society that is related to descriptive representation, and not necessarily about their own loss or their own group loss. So there is evidence accumulating that men and women behave kind of sociotropically regarding descriptive representation. Then another perspective, if you're kind of also justifiably a bit skeptical that there's no backlash at all. There are a couple of maybe important aspects that are related to this study that maybe also differ from other studies. And one is that I presented these trajectories as rather neutral developments, of course, with kind of like a future expectation that is maybe was meant to provoke a bit, but not related to a political party or elite actor or narrative. So I didn't tell connected to this changing trajectory. I didn't say, oh, look, men, this is what will happen in the future for sure, and you will lose out, and then the women in parliament will introduce all of these feminist policies, and this is a sign of overall societal decay. This would be kind of like a narrative that you could expect from a radical right actor, for example. And other studies that have looked at these concrete narratives did find a backlash reaction by male voters to, or did find that these radical right parties can mobilize around these narratives. So I think the political elites or the parties have an important role in actually creating this mobilization around maybe underlying resentments. But I did not find like a strong automatic breeding ground for this resentment in my study without this connection to a narrative. And then maybe also role a word about the role of representation. So I do think that descriptive representation is kind of, or equal descriptive representation is seen as a good thing to a higher extent than, for example, equal outcomes in the labor market or in education. So I think there men, or it has also been shown by other research, that men might feel a stronger threat if their position in the labor market is threatened by an influx of women or by women overtaking them in the labor market, for example. So also I had one interesting item in the survey about whether women and men think that boys' opportunities will be threatened or should be prioritized in the future. And there I did find that the increasing share of women in parliament did lead both men and women to worry more about boys' opportunities. And I think this is related to this also this public debate about boys lagging behind in education and the lower educational outcomes of boys in many countries nowadays. So I think this is this kind of perspective of education and labor market feels more personal to men and women. Interestingly, also to women. And the MPs are, of course, kind of elite actors, kind of removed from the lives of the respondents. So there, they might not care that much that, you know, the next lawyer that sits in parliament is maybe will lose their job in the future. But if it's more men in their own occupation, that feels a lot more personal.
So you would say, if I understand you correctly, the labor market threat and also the connection to the narrative, these are two reasons why your findings don't really speak against the literature on perceived status loss as an explanation for the radical right rise.
I would say that again, I do think that it is a bit more nuanced than to say that there's a strong male backlash reaction in all senses. So I do think that there are tendencies for this, but also it's of course to say that this oftentimes, especially when we talk about radical right mobilization, affects a minority of men. So there are these tendencies that parties can mobilize on, but A, they don't seem to be really connected to representation, and B, it's not as obvious as we thought.
I mean, you already talked a bit about the context and the sociotropic context, and I was wondering about external validity, right? And how might your findings travel to other countries and other contexts, right? For example, I was thinking about Scandinavian countries where the balance of female and male MPs in parliament is more balanced at all. And I was wondering if you would see different effects in other countries, for example, in Scandinavian countries, and what's your take on this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And there is actually also research on Sweden. A lot of the research on like male backlash around gender equality is on the more gender equal context in Sweden, because it seems that this higher level of gender equality in many realms, not only in politics, does lead to a higher threat perception among men. So that if equality is in closer reach, then this threat of women overtaking men is more credible or more believable than it may be in the German context. But I would say that maybe there are a couple of different like clusters of countries, and I think the German context is kind of typical for like the central Western European side, where, for example, also countries like Switzerland, maybe the Netherlands or Spain, where gender inequality has decreased over the long run, but then there has been stagnation in many areas in the last decades, also political fights about gender quotas or other things that have not really progressed much in the last decades.
And in this sense, Sweden would be more of an outlier, right? Because it's not really in the line with the other trends in the other countries you just mentioned.
So I don't know if I would say it's an outlier, but maybe a different cluster of more Nordic countries or countries where the gender equality is already at a different stage. But then, of course, there are also many other factors that are related to this, like the welfare state or other institutions. But I would say that these are kind of two really interesting clusters of countries that, and also they share some similarities, right? But with this male backlash, it seems to matter how believable the threat of gender equality actually is.
Moving to the supply side of this whole dynamic, you already mentioned that for progressive parties can be sort of a winning strategy to mobilize on feminist issues. Maybe like for Green parties, who have a sizable share of female MPs in parliament. I was wondering what the implications of this are. Like, could this be at all a winning strategy for progressive parties to mobilize on unequal representation in parliament? And is it a winning strategy for Green parties to put up more female MPs on the list or mobilize on this issue?
I think it's a really important political question. And I would say that maybe it's good to not only focus on descriptive representation in this aspect, but really to think about broader societal inequalities and how parties frame them or talk about them. And then I think it can be like a winning strategy, as you put it, for progressive parties to raise awareness, to mobilize around existing inequalities and say how they want to dismantle them, and also maybe understand these inequalities in a broad sense. So economic inequalities, cultural inequalities, other social inequalities that are always interrelated, but a lot of times I think are kind of also put into opposition. Like oftentimes we hear about gender or wokeness or stuff like that as a more cultural inequality. But of course, this is about an overall, in the social status perspective at least, about an overall inequality between groups that has many different implications, economic and cultural.
When we talk about a little bit of this like political normative side now, so would you say it's like acceptable to read your article as an argument for the importance of descriptive representation over just a focus on substantive representation in more general?
I don't think I would oppose these perspectives that much. I think, as I also said in the beginning, I do see the descriptive representation as an important dimension of equality in a societal sense overall, and also the inclusiveness of society and the ability to hear different, also marginalized voices. But I think it totally goes along with substantive representation. Like, only if there are enough women or lower class people in parliament will we also hear different perspectives within these groups, right? So I wouldn't oppose these two perspectives, but maybe what was important to me about this progressive mobilization was also to say that this dismantling of inequality is not something that the parties necessarily only strategically induce to kind of increase conflict in society, but this is actually something that like voters care about, or that progressive voters care about. It's not something out of thin air, right? It's a big problem that affects people's lives, and if progressive parties kind of address this need, this is a positive development, in my opinion.
And what about non-progressive parties? What about the radical right and their voters? Do you think that's maybe an issue where the radical right in the future might have some movement on counter-mobilization on it, right? And really mobilize against these perceptions of equality?
I think this is related to like a broader cleavage perspective, where we do see like a sorting or like a mobilization around inequalities and kind of maintaining them versus dismantling them. But I think, like, also coming back to representation now, this is also a more complicated story, because also radical right parties do have female MPs also increasingly, and there's interesting research on how strategic this might be, or what also radical right parties can gain from putting up more women MPs, and also kind of these femi-nationalist positions, so where gender equality is also seen as a value of the national, of the nation, so where it can be instrumentalized to mobilize anti-immigrant sentiments. So I think for radical right parties, it's an interesting time to look at their relation to gender aspects, and it's definitely not the case, I would say, that they are only against all types of gender equality frames, even though, of course, we have to be really critical how they instrumentalize these.
Yeah, of course. I mean, in the last episode, we had Kai Arzheimer here, who talked about the current electorate of far-right parties is mostly male, but, I mean, this might also change a bit in the future. I mean, some studies on there that the Rassemblement National in France and also the AfD in Germany wants to attract more female voters because their current electorate is mostly male. And it might be interesting in the future to look at these strategies, how they employ different frames of gender equality to attract female voters.
Yeah, for sure. And there are some studies now coming out about these feminist nationalist frames. And I think also an important aspect about this is, as we can see with Marine Le Pen or the Rassemblement National, how established the radical right party is, how stigmatized it is, because research has shown that women tend to vote less for these stigmatized parties. So I guess as the longer the party exists, the more maybe it's normalized or also legitimized, which is, of course, a huge part that mainstream politics also play, the more actually we could see a diminishing of the gender gap. But that is a speculation, of course.
Yeah, I mean, just recently, the question of gender gap, especially in the younger cohort, was publicly debated, right? I think, Julius, you were interested in that.
I mean, there was this Financial Times story out there, and it's about a growing gender gap in political attitudes and voting behavior among younger cohorts. And I mean, it's still debated to what degree this actually exists, but I was wondering how this might relate to your argument about status laws and hierarchies in society, and if you would expect to see this divergence maybe growing in the future, because you already mentioned these changes in the labor market, and then females are more likely to have academic degrees, while males might fall back in the labor market. And I was wondering about how this whole story about growing gender gap in attitudes and voting behavior might relate to your argument about social hierarchies and status laws.
I think the social hierarchy aspect, or perception of the social hierarchy, is an important part of the story on the gender gap in maybe attitudes or voting behavior. But it's, of course, very hard to say how this will develop in the future, because it seems to differ a lot by country and even by issue that is being talked about. So labor market would be one thing, but also like this economic insecurity or austerity. I know some research that has shown that if like, because women also tend to be in an economically more vulnerable position, then if austerity is implemented, then the gender gap in attitudes also may diverge. So it's always like there are context effects, country effects, and then also this longer term development of maybe shifting voting patterns between men and women, where that's just also related to to a lot of things, but like decreasing religiosity, or I think the fact that women have always or have been socialized to care more about maybe redistribution issues or be more pro redistribution, or these issues that are often seen as feminized issues like childcare or welfare are more salient to women because of this socialization. So I think there are a lot of aspects where we see long-term and then kind of short-term interventions that lead maybe women to vote more progressively and men less progressively over time. But maybe it's also interesting to distinguish a bit between radical right mobilization versus just less progressive attitudes on a lot of issues. I think in for example, in Germany, there was also this divergence just between the liberals and the Greens for the younger generations, right? So that is not directly related to a backlash, I would say, but yeah.
You mentioned the importance of salience now. That is maybe something we didn't talk so much about yet. Do you think saliency of these sociocultural issues, to put it like this, is key here to understand mobilizing mechanisms?
Yes, for sure. But I think it could be really interesting to look at that. I think it's not necessarily the case that this could not also be applied to economic topics, but maybe certain issue attitudes between men and women are not maybe even that different, but they're like just different priorities by these groups. So, for example, maybe abortion would be an issue where in the US we see, I think, in conservative states, the public opinion is really in favor of abortion. But maybe, and I'm just speculating now, maybe it would be a different priority for men versus women voters to actually act on this concern of being pro-choice. So I do think that even similar attitudes can play out in different voting behavior and different because of the different issue priorities or salience.
Yeah, I mean, again, growing gender gap, it's also a question about age, right? I mean, it's not this whole story about growing gender gap was especially focused on younger cohorts. And I was also thinking about what age plays in this regard, because women and men don't seem to diverge that much in older cohorts. And what's your take on this? Are like different issues more salient to younger women, while older women might be socialized differently in a time period where religious worldviews were more important and the whole socialization was different in Western societies?
Yes, I think that there is an interesting age story here. The socialization in recent times with also more parties that are options for voters, more secular, more maybe also like online media or social media, does lead to a different kind of politicizing context for young voters, and then that may diverge between men and women. Then also events like Me Too or other like progressive forces that maybe attract more women than men, or that lead to a higher support of women than men. But I think also the age question is interesting to me, because this threat that may be perceived by young men entering the labor market, you could also ask, is this a question of trying to enter the labor market at this time, and then maybe this perception of threat will kind of go down once these men are in a more secure position? Entering the labor market is a very insecure time either way. So these are all like questions where I wonder how long or short term are these factors.
We're already coming to an end of the episode now, but can we expect some work from you on that topic in the future? Can you give us a little spoiler?
on generational effects? Or?
Yeah, exactly.
Or what you're working on, just in general.
So I recently started actually my postdoc on a new project that is more related to social class and class appeals by political parties. But and I'm really, of course, interested in how this intersects with the gender. And so especially because if you look at class or class appeals, often we're interested in the changing face of the working class or how they vote. And this is also a really big topic of discussion between social democratic parties and radical right parties. So my future kind of interest is in how these changing face of the working class, more women, more ethnic minorities, may be really interesting to understand current class politics.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much for being on the show. Maybe we'll invite you again.
Thank you so much.
In a couple of years, yes. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you, Magda. Bye.
Bye-bye.
This was the third episode of No Problem At All. If you're interested in Magda's work, we post a link to the paper we talked about in this episode in the podcast description. You can also follow her on social media.
If you enjoyed this episode, please share the podcast and rate it on Spotify or wherever you listen to this. We are also happy to receive feedback, so consider following us on Twitter via the links in the podcast description or send us an email. Thanks for listening and see you next time.
Bye-bye.